A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
Welcome to the History of the Saints podcast. My name is Glenn Rawson, series host. What you are about to listen to is an episode about the documentary history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This episode is one of more than 250 presentations from 1805 and the birth of Joseph Smith the prophet through 1877 and the death of Brigham Young. This series interviews some of the finest scholars of our time and presents the latest in historical research and facts as it relates to early Latter-day Saint history. And it comes from the long-running, highly acclaimed television documentary series, History of the Saints. If you have a desire to learn the history in depth and detail, then this podcast is for you. Thank you for joining us.
The Anthon story fulfills prophecy. The Mitchell story elaborates on history in a way we've never known before. The validation is not just coming from Anthon in the sense, if you will, the fulfillment of prophecy, but it's coming from a scientist of a far greater stature than Anthon was at the time, validating the fact that what you have is legitimate.
By February of 1828, Joseph and Emma Smith are living on Isaac Hale's farm in Harmony, Pennsylvania. Joseph, by this time, had copied some of the characters off of the plates and by the means of the Urim and Thummim had translated a few. It was at this time that a visitor came. He had a very keen interest in what Joseph was doing. His name was Martin Harris.
His wife, Lucy, was not quite so excited about the proposition because she saw it as a possible loss of money for the family. Why are you so fascinated with this young Joseph Smith? What's this going to mean? And she gives her husband quite a tough time with this, as you recall. And so clearly one of the reasons why Martin Harris will go down in 1828 to Harmony with Joseph is, can we get some corroboration for all of this? I'm looking for some support to keep life on an even keel back home.
The Lord appeared unto him in a vision and shewed unto him his marvelous work which he was about to do. And he immediately came to Susquehanna and said the Lord had shown him that he must go to New York City with some of the characters. So we proceeded to copy some of them, and he took his journey to the eastern cities and to the learned. Joseph Smith, Jr.
So somewhere between the two, wanting to get corroboration so that he can financially support Joseph Smith's work and keep peace at home, and the possibility of a spiritual incentive, or perhaps even a heavenly direction. Somewhere between those two poles, Martin Harris is motivated to go down and talk to Joseph Smith early in the winter of 1828 and pleads with him or asks him for a transcript of some of the characters that he's taking off the Book of Lehi and the large plates of the Book of Mormon. You recall that these aren't characters taken from the small plates that eventuate in the Book of Mormon, because that happens in 1829 with Oliver Cowdery between April the 7th and July the 1st of 1829.
Joseph and his wife drew off the characters exactly like the ancient and sent Martin Harris to see if he could get them translated. Joseph Knight, Sr.
This document is sometimes called the Anthon Transcript, but it is probably not the document that Martin Harris carried east.
Now, there is a document with the characters written on them, sometimes called the Anthon Transcript. I don't believe that is the Anthon Transcript. And David Whitmer, initially, when he talked about this piece, said that it was a memento that Joseph wrote down for them at the end of the translation. And I think that's correct. But then later, David Whitmer started saying, yes, this is the Anton transcript. And there's been some more discoveries about this transcript. And I think we're going to find it is a memento of sorts that they had. And there is no translation. And no one's translated it that I know of.
Joseph Smith, I believe, doesn't know how to translate the Book of Mormon just by default. I don't think that the evidence shows that that it's just a given. I believe what the evidence shows is that Joseph Smith has to figure out how to translate the Book of Mormon. And that part of what he's doing in sending Martin Harris with some of the characters and partial translation to the learned scholars of the East is to figure out if he's doing it right, and maybe even to enlist their help, right? Maybe even to get the smartest guys in the world to help him. So I believe that as a result of that, Harris coming back and saying they can't read it, I think that Joseph Smith realizes over time that he's going to have to do it.
There are those who have concluded that Joseph Smith sent Martin Harris to the East with the express purpose of fulfilling the sealed book prophecy in Isaiah 29. But the evidence would lead us to conclude that's not what happened.
I don't think Joseph Smith sends Martin Harris to go see Charles Anton to specifically fulfill Isaiah 29. I don't think they realize that that's what's happened until they are coming almost to the end of the translation process. They're reading in what's now 2 Nephi. Now you may think, well, that's early in the translation process, but probably it's not. They probably begin after the loss of the 116 pages, which we know from the 1830 introduction to the Book of Mormon was an abridgment of the Book of Lehi. So we lose all that, and then we probably begin in what's now the Book of Mosiah, and we translate through the end to Moroni, and then start in 1 Nephi. So they're almost done with the translation process when they get into those chapters late in 2 Nephi that reprise Isaiah's prophecy of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon.
Martin Harris himself would later say that he had no knowledge of that prophecy when he went east.
It was agreed that Martin Harris should follow him as soon as he, Joseph, should have sufficient time to transcribe the Egyptian alphabet, which Mr. Harris was to take east and through the country in every direction to all who were professed linguists to give them an opportunity of showing their talents. Lucy Mack Smith.
It's clear that it's plural, not just one, the Charles Anton that we know so much about. And so early in February, 1828, Martin Harris, who is a farmer, and of course things are kind of quiet on the farm, in February 1828, we assume that he took a stagecoach, because that's probably how they rode in the wintertime, or sleigh in some of the byways and travel ways of upstate New York, and will embark upon a most fascinating expedition to the east.
He gets those manuscripts and goes off to show Samuel Mitchell and Charles Anton. And Joseph and Emma move into their home on the Hell property, what had been the Jesse Hell home. And so now they have their own place that allows them to fully work on the translation of the plates. Emma's pregnant and expecting their first child, a son, as they'll find out later on. She and Joseph work from hour after hour, day after day. Emma serves as his scribe as he's doing translation work that early spring of 1828.
With transcript in hand, Martin Harris set out for New York City. And one of the first stops he made was in Albany, New York, to visit with an old family friend from Palmyra, a Wall Street lawyer named Luther Bradish.
In 1819, 1820, British will make a trip as a secret agent for the United States government. We'll sail over to Istanbul, and during the next few years, we'll be an agent doing many different things for the government, not the least of which was to go, of all places, to Egypt to make reconnaissance of what the British and the French and the other nations are doing in the great expeditions on the Nile. And so what we have, frankly, is our Indiana Jones, who is making a presence for the United States government quietly, comparing what the British are doing, what the French are doing at Thebes and at Dendera and all up and down the Nile River. Now, we have also learned another fascinating chapter about this Luther Bradish. Martin Harris would have been very interested in the fact that someday Joseph Smith may publish a manuscript, that there might be a book forthcoming from the writings that are coming forth from these plates. And eventually we know that that's the case. It's going to cost a lot of money, and who's going to publish them? We've now discovered that Luther Bradish was the literary agent for two of America's greatest novelists. James Fenimore Cooper, who, as you know, wrote so many novels on the early Indians of America, and Washington Irving, the two greatest contemporary writers in America. He was their agent for publishing houses in Philadelphia. So I'm surmising that two or three of the reasons why Martin Harris meets Luther Bradish, A, they were friends, B, Bradish had money as an attorney, a well-established attorney by 1828, C, he had a great knowledge of Egypt and what was happening in Egypt at the time, more so than any other living American, D, he was an agent for the greatest publishing houses in America. That's our first man of the East.
After his conversation with Bradish, Martin went on to New York City.
Now, we know from new sources that have surfaced, particularly the writings of contemporary journalists and reporters in New York City, that the first person that Harris will meet in New York City will be Professor Samuel L. Mitchell. Mitchell, who is a 62-year-old professor at Columbia College and a very kindly man and a Quaker, sends him first to see a young buck, a new grammarian on the block, a man who had studied to be an attorney but became so enamored with the study of classical languages that he changed his entire career path and jumped ship from being a lawyer, and he probably would have been a very successful one, to being a linguist and a scholar of classical languages. And that's none other than Charles Anthon, whom his students called Bull Anthon.
A few years back, History of the Saints began production of 7 seasons of a documentary television series titled History of the Saints. Season 1, Foundations of the Restoration. Season 2, Joseph Smith's Kirtland. Season 3, From Pentecost to Persecution, The Missouri Years. And Season 4, Joseph Smith's Nauvoo. Then 3 more seasons telling the story of Brigham Young and the Saints, beginning with the Nauvoo Exodus in 1846, titled Gathering to the West. Then Building Zion. And finally, The Kingdom Endures. Altogether, over 100 hours of Latter-day Saint pioneer history. For these and all of History of the Saints books and DVD products, visit us at historyofthesaints.org.
Bull Anthon, I think, comes from the fact that he was A, very large man, and B, he didn't tolerate any foolish interruptions. He would blow you out of his office. He was bullish that way. He was not what you would call a person that you would like to spend an afternoon chatting about things. He was a very serious man. He was somewhat of a crotchety bachelor. His life was his books. He hated interruptions. He would not go to faculty parties and socials. When he died on a pile of books, we understand. The man was in love with the learning process to his everlasting great credit. He would speak to his equals or to those of his superiors, but to the inferiors, like a man like Martin Harris, who was an uneducated, unlearned farmer, I can only guess at the quality of the tenor of their conversation that afternoon sometime in mid-February 1828.
I went to the city of New York and presented the characters which had been translated, with a translation thereof to Professor Charles Anthon, a gentleman of celebrated literary attainments, Martin Harris.
When Harris visits with him, he begins to tell the story of where he got these characters that are shown to him. Anthon does look at them very, very carefully and asks them very pointed questions and is really concerned about his financial welfare. Questions such as, well, where did you obtain these characters? Who gave them to you? What is their origin? And after making quite a learned dissertation on them, writes something of a letter, or at least an affidavit to the fact that these do look somewhat legitimate.
He gave me a certificate certifying to the people of Palmyra that they were true characters, and that the translation of such of them as had been translated was also correct. Martin Harris.
But then he asks Harris, well, where did you get them? And of course, we understand that story, and Harris says, well, I got them from a young man, Joseph Smith, who got them from a book, a gold plates, from an angel. We don't know what Anthon was thinking, whether it was to protect what he thought Harris might be losing in mortgaging a farm to support this, or for whatever other reason, he asked for the certificate back, whatever he had written, and tears it up after hearing from Harris that Joseph got them from a sealed book. He says, I cannot read a sealed book. And in a very real sense, fulfills, as we've long taught, Isaiah prophecy.
The learned said, I cannot, but if he would bring the plates, they would read it. But the Lord had forbid it. He returned to me and gave them to me to translate. And I said, I cannot, for I am not learned. But the Lord had prepared spectacles for to read the book. Therefore, I commenced translating the characters. And thus the prophecy of Isaiah was fulfilled. Joseph Smith, Jr.
Now, of course, Martin declined Anthon's offer, and Anthon suggested that he go back and meet with Dr. Mitchell.
Anthon will invite him to go back to see Mitchell for more discussion, because Anthon says Mitchell is by far the greater scholar. Now, who is this Samuel Latham Mitchell, whom Anthon refers to as the greater scholar? That's our third man of the East. In 1828, Mitchell is reaching the end of an illustrious career as arguably America's greatest naturalist. It's fascinating to understand that Martin Harris was talking to the man that President Thomas Jefferson called a walking congressional dictionary. Mitchell, who's a Quaker, has time for everyone. He was a pleasant, cheerful personality who loved to entertain presidents and paupers, would give anyone the time of day. Well, what do you have there? Now, why did he develop this great love? He had been a student of upstate Indian history for the last 35 years. He had been adopted into the tribes of many of the great Indian nations in upstate New York, the Iroquois, for instance, and the Mohawk, and several other tribes. He had made the effort to learn their languages and their cultures and their origins and their derivations, and was an honored son of many of those tribes. He was one of the founding fathers and great participants in the American Philosophical Society, headquartered in Philadelphia, New York. By the time Harris comes on the scene, he had come up with a theory, which he had published at least 8 years before, that the American Indian were a magnificent people anciently, and that the derivation had come from two stocks of people. He arrived at the conclusion that the two had come into conflict anciently and had been fighting each other over a vast period of time, and eventually came to one great culminating series of final battles that he believed occurred in upstate New York, and that the final battle occurred at a place called Downton's Hill, about 60 miles southeast of Rochester, New York, not far from where Joseph Smith claims to have received the golden plates.
Based on his extensive and varied research, Dr. Mitchell had also concluded that America was the cradle of human civilization, and that the Garden of Eden itself was, he said, somewhere near Onondaga in the state of New York.
Hence, when Mitchell and Harris meet with one another, Mitchell very kindly says, well, let me see. What do you have here? Tell me the story. So Harris will share with him the characters that he had brought from Joseph Smith. Professor Mitchell was comparing them not with just anything, but to the great works of Champollion, which were just now coming out. And after having done that, he set them down as the language of a people formerly in existence in the East, but now no more. So we have the situation of this third wise man of the East, considered to be America's greatest naturalist, giving validation to the fact that these characters, after having compared them with the greatest linguists of the age, look legitimate and may very well have come from the ancient peoples that he himself had studied up until that time. When Martin Harris returns to Joseph Smith after his visit to Columbia College, he believes he has validation that the characters which Joseph Smith gave him from the large plates were valid, not a made-up story. No wonder that Harris is willing now, even at the expense perhaps of his own family, to move forward to support the translation and eventual publication of the Book of Mormon.
It was March of 1828 when Martin Harris got back from New York City. He was more determined than ever to help Joseph. He was going to go to Harmony, and his wife Lucy Harris decided to go with him. However, no sooner did the Harrises arrive at Joseph and Emma's home than Lucy Harris began to ransack the house looking for the plates. When she didn't find them inside, she went outside and began to tear apart the property. She came to a place where she thought they might be. She stooped down and began scraping away the leaves and the snow when a large black snake reared its head and began hissing at her. Well, Lucy ran for the house, gathered up her belongings, and moved to a nearby tavern. Lucy Mack Smith records after that what Lucy Harris began to say about Joseph to all who would listen.
She continued her operations while she remained in Harmony, doing all that her ingenuity could contrive to injure Joseph in the estimation of his neighbors.
As you can imagine, Martin promptly took his wife home. And then, notwithstanding her opposition and her threats, he determined to go back to Harmony and help Joseph. He set out, leaving his angry wife behind. From the 12th of April till about the 14th of June, 1828, Joseph dictated and Martin scribed. That manuscript would later come to be called the 116 pages. And it is that story where we commence when we return. I'm Glenn Rawson, and we'll see you then. Thank you for listening. If you would like more information on what you have listened to, please go to historyofthesaints.org. The History of the Saints team that produced this podcast has also produced numerous books and full-length documentaries on early Latter-day Saint church history and the key figures that made that history. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast of History of the Saints has been produced by Dennis Lyman and Glenn Rawson. History of the Saints is a 501c3 nonprofit organization.